everyone. I'm LNT. If I haven't met you, very happy to see everybody there in the dirt zendo and in the cloud here. I have been a mostly cloud-based member of Bright Way Zen since 2020. I took vows in the Jukai ceremony of 2021 there in the dirt. And I live just outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I own and operate a small bookstore with my partner, Kevin. And I'm the mom of two adult-ish sons. They're in their early 20s. Also helping my parents with their increasing needs. I'm a representative of the sandwich years right now. So the title of my talk is Women of the Way Today. And I'm focusing mostly on the experience of 20th and 21st century Soto Zen women. So I'm going to start with a quote. And I actually found this quote on the website of the Pacific Zen Institute. Fierce and wise, in myriad ways, these women sought freedom amidst their circumstances, just as we do today. And their influence begins as early as the time of the first woman ancestor, Prajnotara, teacher of Bodhidharma. So this is not going to be a thesis or anything wonky based on, you know, quantitative evidence that women and or non-binary people are not afforded the same opportunities for practice or the opportunity to ordain within our lineage in the present day or even in recent history. It's really more of an anecdotal, oral, and written history. I'm very interested in the lived experience of this. So to start, earlier, as part of our chanting service B, we offered the merit of our recitation of the precious mirror samadhi with the phrase, may we live our lives in such a way that we honor all those beings, women and men, known and unknown, who gave their lives to the Dharma for our present benefit. And in service B, as we heard today, we recite the names of women, ancestors, mostly of old. It's clear that the list of women is quite a bit shorter than the one we recite in service A, and that's okay. Give us a couple hundred years. So in Zen history, you know, we're talking about dating all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. And I really enjoy chanting the names each week and hearing the chorus of everyone's voices chanting the names. I've sometimes been curious enough to kind of look some of these figures up, just Googling a bunch of bodhisattvas with varying degrees of success. And I do this for both the male and female ancestor list to add a little bit of dimension to my understanding. And maybe next time I recite the names, I'll remember something about them. Maybe not. My memory isn't what it used to be. But as I said, I'm really interested in stories. And I'm also interested in your stories. So we'll leave plenty of time for questions and remarks. And as I talk, maybe you can consider how your gender identity, your expression of gender, your lived experience as a person of any gender has affected or informed your spiritual path. And also, maybe if you have background in another faith tradition, how you feel it might differ in terms of gender norms, especially perhaps for women and non-binary people. Has there been a time when you hit a wall on your spiritual path due to perceived or very real limitations based on gender? And if so, how did you reckon with this? Has your church or synagogue or mosque or other congregation made strides toward elevating women and also LGBTQ plus folks? So here's a funny little thing about me. I've had a lifelong fascination with nuns, Catholic nuns. I'm not kidding. My whole life, I was really smitten. There are two convents nearby. And so when I was young, the nuns were still habited, so they were very visible. And I just thought that, the quiet and the serenity of their life was very appealing. It might be inconvenient for a Jewish kid like me to be thinking about entering the convent, but no, I just something about, the serenity of what they did. And I still love to read about people in monastic settings. I've made the acquaintance recently, or in the past few years, of two nuns at the grocery store. We seem to be on the same circuit there. And I've invited them to the bookstore and hoping they'll offer me an invite to the Cedar Gardens, which are famous. My interest in monasticism has definitely persisted. And I've been drawn to books and films about nuns and monks, though my strong desire to raise children won out. So that was a choice. And even at this point, as an empty nester, choosing a monastic path would not feel skillful for me in terms of my personal vow to help my parents. And that's just my personal experience as a woman, mother, and daughter. Who knows what the future holds? Multiple session each year is probably more realistic, but I do have this kind of each time I've gone and visited a monastery, or each time I'm at session, I do have this almost dream of living that way. And I imagine that many, many people from a variety of faith traditions that have a cloistered option or a monastic path face these conundrums. And aside from personal agency and the ability to make choices about one's future path, we know that women have faced barriers to practice across many religions. There's interpretation of scripture and different norms that restrict women's roles and participation. And there's a website, and this was wonky actually. There's a website called Number Analytics, and there are a few good quotes about the role of women, not women as a monolith, because we're not, the role of women in different religions. And it said these barriers can manifest as exclusion from leadership roles, limitations on participation in rituals or services, and pressure to conform to traditional gender roles within religious contexts. Some Christian denominations might restrict women from ordination or leadership roles, while others might have different expectations for women's participation in services or rituals. Muslim women may face restrictions on their public participation due to needs of modesty and veiling practices. Women may be sometimes excluded from certain rituals or leadership positions due to interpretations of Jewish law, and that can limit their role within their community. So, what about our tradition as Soto Zen Buddhists, specifically here in the West, in which we practice? Well, we refer often to Dogen, of course, who said that there is no difference between men and women in the ancient teaching. So while he said this, he did not take major steps toward institutionalizing women's authority or creating learning paths for women to help women practice. There were no convents established. And women weren't placed in positions of authority until they really started to make noise about it. Dogen also said, and so this is where some conflict comes in, and I'll be eager to hear your thoughts about this. No monk or nun can attain it, meaning Buddha, Dharma, unless he or she has the mind of one who has left home. A monk or nun who has the mind of a lay person has twice as many faults. Their attitude should be very different. So that might sound to you like it rules out the experience of some women more than men, because we might be less likely or able to be home leavers. And as Sally Tisdale says in Women of the Way, responsibility for childcare keeps many committed Buddhist women out of monasteries, even for brief retreats. And she also said, it's hard to be outside something for which we feel ourselves designed, to be forbidden to be the person we think ourselves to be. But there are, of course, fewer obstacles to participating as a lay practitioner than ever before, thanks to Zoom and the like. Parents of young kids and other caregivers, those with economic hardship or stressful job requirements, those who are ill or in difficulty now have more access and flexibility. So taking a look at our very own beloved Brightway Zen there, both in the dirt and the cloud, in terms of representation of gender, we're rather evenly represented, if attendance today is any indication. But as an aside, glancing around, we notice that we're not especially diverse when it comes to ethnicity and race. This seems to be the case for most American sanghas, alas. But in terms of gender identity and sexual orientation, Buddhism in the West, as I perceive it, seems inclusive currently. We have the dedication of female ancestors to thank for that, as well as supportive men, of course. And those who in the past and present yearn for the opportunity to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, were harnessing the power of their chosen path, and they had to use that power to break through established barriers and continue to. So back in 2017, on one of Domyo's earliest podcasts, I think it's number 16, she was talking about Sangha. She said that originally, during the time of Shakyamuni Buddha, the Sangha was technically just the ordained monks and nuns. Members of the Sangha shared common vows and a full-time, intensive, formal way of practice. The whole of the people who practiced was known as the fourfold Buddhist community. That was the ordained monks and ordained nuns, the lay women and lay men. So I guess you could say these four categories persist, but with many, many, many more folks choosing a lay path. And certainly this benefits everyone who has family or career commitments as well as health conditions. And we could also say that like the gender binary was more rigid in the past. I mean, it seems to me the past few years we've made some strides, especially in terms of LGBTQ plus designations and really embracing that. But when it comes to some rights and expression of identity, it feels like we're sliding backward due to the far right, perhaps, imposing their religious interpretations. So we know that there were these extraordinary women and teachers and students all the way back to India and China and into Japan before Buddhism made its way here to the West. And some women took up the Dharma. They were really bent on seeking awakening and, you know, in very challenging circumstances or in times when their fate was not their own. There was not their choice. They might have met arranged marriages or even conditions that resembled slavery. Others found their way to convents, which might have provided a sanctuary. And then, you know, also even seeking a divorce was extremely difficult and rare, or another way of living, an alternative way of living. It's not, was not otherwise available in common life. So how have things been playing out for Buddhist women in the 20th and 21st centuries? First, we'll take a look at some of the lives of the women ancestors on the list we just recited. I've been looking them up a bit, just, you know, when they were born, when they died. And then we'll look at some of the stories from in this body, in this lifetime, which is, as you can see, Awakening Stories of Japanese Soto Zen Women. This has been published in English for the first time just this year, just a couple months ago. And it's from the students of Sozen Nagasawa Niroshi, whose name we recite. She lived from 1888 to 1971. We'll also I'll refer to some excerpts from Women of the Way by Sally Jiko Tisdale, who is the Dharma sibling of Daimyo. So In This Body, In This Lifetime was recently published, as I said, for the first time in English. And it's a collection of personal essays by her students, by Nagasawa Roshi's students. She was really considered a pioneer of women's monastic Zen practice in Japan, and really demonstrated a fiery desire to enter monastic training from a young age. And she had to persevere through extreme societal pressures, also facing real obstacles, having to, in order to become an abbess, she had to, and she trained and eventually trained hundreds of students, primarily women. But, the women of her generation, this was extremely rare. So she won equal rights for Japanese nuns, established organizations to support nuns and lay women practitioners. And she was known for both her compassion and also kind of ferocity. She did not suffer fools gladly. And time and again in this book, there are these women in monastic training who are just sweating it out on the cushion. They're just, they are definitely, trying to demonstrate Kensho enlightenment. They're trying very hard. And to their dismay, their teacher would say, nope, that's not it yet. Keep going. Keep trying. And as more and more students awakened, she would ask them to write about their experiences. And that's the stories that were originally published in a Japanese magazine and then compiled into a book published in Japan, which was the forebearer of this. It's 30 first-person accounts exclusively from women. I find them really fascinating. They're an intimate look into both the personal lives and also like the spiritual determination of these women who long to awaken, and despite the obstacles that they faced. And let me tell you, this book is full of mu. She was fond of koan practice. So I'm just going to read a brief excerpt from the foreword. The foreword is by Paula Arai, who also gathered a lot of quotes and blurbs here. But anyway, one of the things she's setting the scene here, she said, primarily in the aftermath of World War II, Nagasawa Roshi midwifed lay and monastic women through the painful journey that opened each of them up to the liberating joy and gratitude of living mu. In this book, you witness the power of the teacher through the depth and the disciples go through to break through, the intensity of pain and anguish the women endure to be released from dualistic delusions is palpable through the vulnerability and raw honesty they courageously share. Their stories overflow with tears and repentance. Doubts of self-worth leak through. Reliance on others, including ancestors, Buddhas, and Bodhisattvas, especially canon, is resolute. And so I find that part especially kind of poignant because I, too, put a lot of... I look to Kanzeon a lot for the idea of comfort for the world. And since she's often figured or represented as a woman, it seems apt. Paula Arai, wrote a book called Women Living Zen also. And so, I've incorporated some of her words here too, but just some quotes from the women in these stories, these first person accounts, that are just incredibly meaningful. So Nagasawa Roshi advises Zenkai Yamauchi, wash your whole body and mind with those tears and come back. So that shows how insistent she was on persistence. But now my body and mind have become light, and I know that helping others means you must forget yourself and dive into the state of mind of that person, becoming one with their joy and their suffering. And that was Setsujo Uchiyama. Another quick quote, even such a wretch as me could penetrate Mu, Reverend Tokyo Ito. And then, yeah, searching for this truth, one must confess everything and make one's mind totally honest. Reverend Gyokusen Tanimori. So, you know, it's the wisdom of the monastic and lay disciples of Nagasawa Roshi kind of resounding through this work. And I think it really does go far in illuminating and inspiring us. We live in kind of a cushy setting as lay people, often, even if you are financially uncomfortable, it's likely that you're not feeling the same pain as others. And she insisted on pushing through that pain, on pushing through pain in general. It's something that I find difficult personally. So reading how incredibly strict she was is both frightening and illuminating. I'm going to read another little bit here, if I can find that. Where'd it go? So in one of the essays, Sharing the Joy of Awakening by Reverend Kanko Ishimoto, she said, having received this difficult to receive human body, and having met with the hard-to-meet true Dharma, I am truly grateful. I can't help but prostrate before 1,000 Buddhas and 1,000,000 ancestors, shedding tears of joy. After the war, the state of our society worsened. People were only concerned with living, finding food, and making their reputations. They were becoming slaves to money, depraved. It was truly a pitiful sight. So many lost people without faith. Every day the newspaper reported on the increase in crime. Everywhere you looked, the world was full of falsehood. Are things really okay like that? Where is the truth? People's conversations lacked warmth and authenticity. Why do human beings exist at all? I had not the slightest idea. I longed to hear something of the highest importance. Any doctrine is fine, I thought. I just wanted to listen to a true teaching, to rely on someone dignified who could give me peace of mind. Now, so of course, reading that, thinking of the parallels of today, living in this time of a little bit of terror, actually, for me, instability for sure, distrust of our political system, and she. You know, women, these women's voices in all of these stories, even though most of them were living monastically under these very difficult conditions that that Nagasawa Roshi was setting, there are all of these quotes from them that really resonate today. So to say that Nagasawa Roshi was a challenge to them is not adequate. The same woman, the same writer here, Kanko Ishimoto, said, the faith that gushes forth from the depths within us, that is the real faith, All the Buddhas of the three worlds are sitting with us, trying to help us. How truly grateful I was, how precious the Zendo was filled with earnestness, intensity, a life and death struggle. One 10,000-mile-long iron bar. With strong faith, I pushed forward. The venerable abbess continued to press me, saying with her frightening face, "Show me, Mu. Come on, show it." I had run out of tears, and my voice wouldn't come out anymore. It was a pain and anguish not of this world. So one of the things I wonder about is the assumption, maybe the assumption, and we can discuss this in a few moments, that that women were made of softer stuff, you know, and that weren't up to the challenge of that type of training. And I, you know, I'll be eager to hear your thoughts about that. Was that the common perception? And just one more little piece here, and then I'll open it up to conversation. So in the chapter entitled "Being Worthy of the True Dharma" by Ms. Chido Ikai, this is someone who was making her way down a traditional life path. I was born in a snowy village in Niigata Prefecture, the second child of eight. After graduating high school, I was married into the Ikai family. I was 19 years old. For 20 years, I was taken care of by a deeply loving husband and his parents, far from the rough waves of the world. I was blessed with two beloved children, and maternal love opened my eyes and heart of compassion. I threw my life into raising them. I grew acutely aware of the preciousness of life, and gradually I felt I should search for a deeper way to live. So she goes on to say that she found an organization, and she was introduced to Nagasawa Roshi, and she even met her at a train station. And there was just something about this moment. You know, we all of us have a moment, perhaps, or maybe more than that if we're lucky, that turns our destiny towards something else. But I'm really curious about stories in which women of any age are on a certain traditional trajectory and then are not anymore because of their own choices. So with all of that said, I was hoping to turn some thoughts and conversation over to you, all of you, not just women. and does anything occur to you in terms of what I've asked? Do you feel like it was women were considered softer and therefore unworthy of monastic training? Do you feel like in your other, if you have another religious tradition, that there are the same opportunities for women as exist currently? Excuse my cat. She's scrabbling frantically to get out of the room here. I'm going to open it up to questions. Thank you so much, everyone. Questions in the dirt. Is that questions in the, if you're in the cloud, you can either use the little yellow hand thing, or you can just shout, I guess. Wait, let me let my cat out of this torture. Okay, we're back. Who's that? Kara?
It's Kara, like a Care Bear. I just before I say anything, I know in the very beginning of your talk, which thank you so much. This has been pretty like illuminating for me. You had spoken about like people's experience of like gender impacting their path. Are you okay with me saying talking about that, or would you prefer
Oh,
to?
absolutely. Yeah, no, that's one of the things I'm inviting for sure.
Okay. So I had read this book a while ago. It's by Zen priest. I hope I say her name correctly, Ursuline Manuel, and she wrote for, and I hope, yeah, so it sounds like you're familiar, and she talks about awakening through race, sexuality, and gender. And so I'm non-binary, and it's interesting because people say, like, non-binary people, like, if you have some kind of identity like that, it's like a delusion and it needs to be abandoned. And they say that about, like, race too, like, it's not real, and they kind of invalidate. Completely invalidate kind of the experience and suffering of those people based on those identities. And sometimes they kind of use them as an excuse not to do anything about it because they're like, oh, racism isn't real anymore. I don't see race, whatever, et cetera, et cetera. That kind of thing. And like Sangha, I've always, especially in Zen, like heard about the emphasis of the importance of Sangha on like it's so important for your path. And then if there are folks in the Sangha, which I'm not saying that's happening here or whatever, but sometimes it can be like subconscious, it's like kind of dismissing folks as not being real, as not being real, you know? And so I also find it interesting that people don't often like societally fixate on abandoning like identities like man or woman or straight or white. Like it's always like Black or queer or whatever, that's what needs to be abandoned because those are delusions. And it's like, okay, so reading that book, which 100% was super helpful for me and kind of why I'm saying this for other folks who might be experiencing this in their lives, is that she talks about how these kind of identities and experiences can be like vehicles for awakening and like kind of part of the substance and like kind of realities of our path, instead of being like, oh, you need to abandon that. It's like, no, you need to examine that and look at that, and like this is part of your journey. And so that helps me be like, okay, I do exist, you know, I like this is valid and something that is a part of my life and I experience. And that has really helped me a lot, in terms of like at least with myself, because there's all this like, you know, whatever society is saying, I can kind of tell my counter that within myself, so I'm not kind of getting overwhelmed. So yeah, that's it. Thank you so much for your talk again.
Thank you. Emily J is asking me to put the book title in the chat, so I'm going to do that right now. Jinryu, you're coming up, or is somebody else in the chair?
Always the struggle to figure out which way I'm supposed to sit. Ellen, this was wonderful. I was just looking forward to your talk so much based on the title, and it was really great.
Thank
And
you.
in this body, in this lifetime, I want to write that down as well. I very much appreciated what Kara had to say. And to your question of our women, what was it? Are we softer? Are we less able to take it? Is that
Or was that per the perception, and has it been alleviated? I don't know.
I haven't studied to know whether it was the perception or not. I think it was probably bigger that it feels like it was more like this is not the place for women to be. And I also think that bringing it to the 20th century and the 21st century, I wonder if those of us living now aren't particularly sensitive. Now, I don't know why I've had this on my mind over the past week, but I have thought of a story of a male priest here in Portland where if the story is true, I thought he was particularly cruel to a person who didn't get the form right. I know of a story that was told in front of a woman priest. So because the story was told in front of her, it had to have been true, but she was particularly mean and nasty to this young female monk. And on about in some people, male or female, the rigid nature in which they approach and molding and so forth. I don't know if that's a throwback to Japan. I don't know if they went to Japan experience and they feel like they need to bring that forward. All I know is that if someone spoke to me the way I have heard people being spoken to in other communities, I would not be able to come back. And part of that is my own sensitivity for sure. But another part of it is, aren't we being taught compassion? Aren't we being taught loving kindness? And so if we are, is there a better way for you to correct what I just did rather than raising your voice to me in front of everybody? That's kind of the thought that I'll contribute that got me going as you were talking. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, and in the case of Nagasawa Roshi, she was fierce, right? She took no prisoners. So first, and she's a woman. So she's, did that come across differently than it might have if she was a man? I don't know. And when men in power kind of abuse their position. And yeah, as you said, Jinryu, I wouldn't have returned there. I don't take that. I don't like being yelled at or scolded in front of a group. As you said, there are better ways for sure. Ewan?
I'd like to reiterate what others have said, and thank you, Ellen, for
Thank
that. I think it was, I've written down all the book recommendations as people have been going through, and I think I'll be making a substantial order after the call. I'm a I've been lucky enough over the last 10 years to work in health and social care, which I'm imagining it's virtually identical in the US as it is in the UK in terms of the vast majority of that labour being done by women. And if anyone's under the misapprehension that that's an easy job, I'd quite like to dispel that. And I've been lucky to work with a number of women that after a 14, 24-hour, 36-hour shift of hard physical labor are still able to be emotionally attentive to the people that they're supporting and ensuring that disabled people are having a good day and being respected and valued. And I think being able to do both of those things speaks to a level of capacity that just doesn't get understood very well, do you know? And I was very lucky to have learned from them. And I think what you were saying about different religious traditions having those very gendered ideas, I think speak. I grew up getting to hear stories from my family, from my gran and my great gran about it's called the Wee Free Church. I think the closest equivalent would be a bit would be like Southern Baptism in the US. And the way that women were treated in that, and why there was a fairly mass exodus from our family when they got to a stage of being able to do that, and they became very political and involved in things like reproductive right campaigning and things like that. But other gendered aspects of society were very held on to. But hearing the stories about how liberatory it was for the women in my family to be able to get involved with, And I think part of the reason that I kept looking until I found Bright Way was that Domio in the podcast that I'd listened to had never shied away from discussing issues of gender and sexuality and race, and as a disabled person as well, it was hugely affirming to hear someone that I was getting spiritual guidance from talking about those things in a way that was very understanding and, as others have said, compassionate. I've not got a huge amount to add other than you've given me a lot of reading and learning to do, which I really appreciate. And yeah, I'm looking forward to doing the research and learning more. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, that was my reaction to you. And when I first heard Domio all those years ago on the podcast, was that she was representing something that I, definitely wanted to be a part of. So, Joan, why am I forgetting your Dharma name? Yuko? Is that right? Yuko, that's right. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for this talk, Ellen. This has been great. I really appreciate it. And I guess my question is, you've said quite a few times she was so fierce. Why was she so fierce? Was it because, that's the way she was taught, and she felt like she had to teach her students that way to have them measure up, or what all was that about? Because she could have done it a different way. And so I don't know, I'm just curious about the fierceness.
Yeah, I don't know if that's a per it was just her personality characteristic, because it does say that there, and there it shows there are instances of compassion. She was really trying to get people to push through to move. She That's really the essence of this book, is that pushing, that striving. And I have a question about that too. Is that level of like grasping and striving, isn't it kind of apart from what we're often taught? Right? We don't want to grasp too much. Yeah, but her ferocity that way kind of got her to where she was, like maybe. But is that because it was associated with more of a more male set of personality characteristics? I don't know. But I mean, even in 20th and 20th century, like we know some teachers who and women teachers who are more forthright in our very own semi-recent lineage, right? So
Yeah. Or did she feel she had to be even more fierce because she was a woman?
yeah,
I mean, thank
I think
you.
that's true. Thank you, Yuka. Online, Ray.
Thank you for this, Ellen, and I appreciate everybody who's shared so far. I always feel like all my thoughts get jumbled together.
Me too.
But yeah, I was raised Catholic, and I left the church really young, not for necessarily any gender-related reasons or anything, but as I would visit my mom over the years and she'd want me to go to church, I felt just deeply uncomfortable being there for so many reasons, partially just because I don't believe, but also because especially based on my sexuality or other parts of me that just didn't feel accepted, let alone celebrated or represented. And it's definitely felt better coming to Bright Way and seeing other trans and non-binary people and other queer people, people putting pronouns, in in Zoom and things like that. And you know, it's sort of like a, I don't feel like my gender has particularly affected my spiritual or religious, you know, experience, but it's just sort of that baseline level of even being able to be comfortable and, you know, bring your full self to something. Like, how can you even attempt to be spiritual or deeply learn or even be comfortable, like being silent in a room for 20 minutes, you know, or, you know, whatever it is, and not feel comfortable there, you know? So, it just feels like the basic price of admission that, that we should have to be in that kind of space. And it's sad to me that a lot of people, whatever, you know, religion, or spiritual practice they have, might not have that basic level of comfort.
Yes, very much so. And, you know, as someone, you know, I have a secular Jewish background, never religious. And, you know, I don't have as deep an understanding of which denominations of Christianity tend to be these days more inclusive and welcoming. I do know that the two Presbyterian churches in my neighborhood are, have made extremely good efforts toward that, you know, with pride flags and one has a TikTok account where he's extremely welcoming. So, but in Judaism, as far as I mean, you know, there's different sects. There's Reform Judaism, which is known to be a little bit more relaxed, perhaps, and also Reconstructionist, where there are women rabbis and have been for quite some time now. And I, it would be hard to imagine in that setting, someone feeling uncomfortable being a woman in the congregation. However, you know, orthodoxy still, of course, exists, and they still sit in a different room as men. So, okay, James.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you so much for this discussion. It's very interesting, and you know, I've had an opportunity to reflect on my own experience with practice. I started my as a child. My father was a minister in the Assemblies of God Church in the Midwest in the Bible Belt primarily. And so you want to talk about you said you didn't know which denominations of Christianity were more accepting. Well, I could tell you the Assemblies of God were not. So it was very, very sexist, very, and a certain degree racist and whatnot, very backwards, you know, and the people that were in those churches and the leadership of those churches are the people who right now would be like, you know, straight up MAGA supporters and whatnot. And fortunately for me, my dad never could buy into that. He actually left a church when the deacons of the church wanted to mandate that women could only wear dresses to church and not pants. And that was like, he was like, yeah, screw you guys, I'm out of here. You know, I can't do this. So I was lucky that I was exposed to that, but I didn't get it at home too. And so then years later, you know, the agnostic for most of my adult life. And then when I came to Buddhism, I entered in the Theravada Thai forest tradition, which is extremely male dominated. And in some of the variations of that, it's like just straight up sexist and completely closed off to women. Fortunately, I entered a tradition that had a more liberal viewpoint about it. And Longpo Pasano, who is the head of that order at the Abhayagiri Monastery in Northern California, he couldn't ordain women into the monastery because it's all male monastery. But he did what he figured was the next best thing, and he started a program to do lay ordination and ordain lay teachers to carry on the tradition. And I just happened to enter a community that was led by one of these women. There were like I think five people in the group, and two of them were men, and three of them were women, and she was one. So I was early on exposed to a lot of equality, even in that very male dominated and sometimes sexist sect of Buddhism, there was this, you know, approach to equality. And then, you know, I came through the Rinzai and there was a male teacher, but he's very, very open-minded and very, very equality-minded. And then I'm Domyo there, and, you know, it's, and I've realized over all of this that I've kind of preferred to have a woman teacher. Like I didn't consciously come to Bright Ways Zen because Domyo was a woman. I said, I want to study with a woman, but I realized that subconsciously that was there, because I think Yuan made this point in a different way, but it's like this myth that women are softer, made of softer stuff, is so completely freaking ridiculous. I can't even believe that that's still, that, you know, that myth has persisted for all these, you know, millennia. But just the strength to hold compassion and fierceness in Nagasawa's case at the same time, where, you know, a lot of men would just choose the fierceness. I don't have time for the compassion side of it, you know. And then also to a degree that kind of you see all these stories of misconduct in Zen, and it's always men. It's like, good God, this is not supposed to be happening, you know? And so I think subconsciously I was like, this is a safe space, you know, for women, for men, for non-binary, for everybody. I think for me personally, I feel safe here in a way that maybe I wouldn't in a male dominated tradition, just again, because of everything that I've observed. So yeah, I don't know. That was a string of random thoughts, but I just wanted to share.
Thank you. Yeah, and I don't have as much experience in Theravada, and, you know, really only some visits. So I didn't have a sense of that overt kind of preference for men. I'm going to look into that. So I guess what you're saying, James, is that not only Bright Way Zen, but American Zen is more open-hearted in terms of women's participation. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Jill in the cloud.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this talk and everyone's sharing. I'm thinking about some work I did like in 2018 with Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams, who I believe is the second African-American woman, just queer woman, that was ordained in the Zen Peacemakers lineage, if I'm remembering that correctly. But she did this 2-day workshop in Portland, and it was profoundly impactful. And it was also really unusual because it was kind of like a social justice talk for Dharma people and a Dharma talk for social justice people. So it was sort of like the room was half social justice folks like working in different ways. And then the other half of the room were Dharma folks. There were a lot of Dharma Rain people there. And it was so, I remember it so well that like she really framed nicely, and she does this really well, pointing out that like the Zen traditions are fully influenced by all the different systems of oppression that exist in the world. So, you know, women, race, gender identity, sexual orientation, all of the different kinds of oppression. And it was this sort of call to the Dharma folks to like learn, like there's this opportunity to make your space more inclusive, and a recognition that there's likely like not even an awareness that the space isn't inclusive, because there isn't an awareness of what it's like to live in another identity. And then the flip side is like the social justice people were like, what is this Dharma thing that's happening to me? This is a very powerful weekend and experience. And it was, I love her work. I think it's really powerful. And I think her experience is like where I know the most about sort of what it's like to be different in this lineage. My personal experience hasn't really been like that, but this talk really made me think about that. So thank you.
Thank you. All right, do we have time for one more? Who's in the chair? Oh, yeah. Do we have time, you think?
It's 12:15. Maybe a little long, though. Thank you again, Ellen, for the talk. My name's Scott. I'll try to make it brief, but basically I grew up in the Presbyterian tradition, ended up at Lewis and Clark College, where studying world religions was introduced to others to D.T. Suzuki's writings, which planted a seed of Zen back then. But also Catholicism opened up a whole new world with the documents of Vatican II. And eventually, I was going to go into the Presbyterian ministry, ended up joining Catholicism, became a Catholic priest with the Congregation of Holy Cross from the University of Portland and Notre Dame and several other colleges. And then I was a member of Holy Cross for 23 years, from 75 through 98, and was an ordained priest for 15 years. And came out as a gay man in 1978 to my family and friends in Holy Cross. And it was a very hopeful time because Vatican II was open to the world. There was this great hope of learning from psychology and sociology and physics and everything under the sun. And along came John Paul II and Joseph Ratzinger, who eventually became Benedict, Pope Benedict. And things began to tighten down. So I had done two masters in theology, was working on my doctorate in Toronto on liturgical theology, which had the Eucharist, the Lord's Supper as the focus. And the question we always had was, who gets to sit in the big chair, as we used to put it? In other words, who can be ordained to lead the community? And I always said, it's a these are sacraments of faith. This is about people who have courage and who step forth in their lives, you know, to be compassionate and care for the poor and the needy and all that. So yes, women, look around, who's doing that? The nuns, the Catholic nuns. We had Catholic nuns in Holy Cross. We had brothers, sisters, and priests. And the nuns were always the ones who were the most faithful and the most passionate and joyful, unlike a lot of the dour priests that I had to live with. Not all of us, of course. The gay guys were a lot more enjoyable. It had to be. But I realized when they started firing, Ratzinger started firing theologians for even talking about women's ordination. And that was a directive from John Paul II to Ratzinger, who was in charge of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, the CDF, which used to be known as the Holy Office of the Inquisition in previous centuries. But they started firing people, including the first one was a Catholic nun from my faculty of theology in Toronto, where I was studying at University of St. Margaret's College. She had graduated from there. She was fired without due cause. Theologians from the Catholic Theological Society took out two four-page ad in the New York Times to sign saying, you know, we protest this. There was no conversation. Rome just blacklisted them, including a couple of my professors who were at a Jesuit faculty of got canned, and they were not allowed to continue on to tenure. And then eventually friends of mine who were, one was a pastor of the Metropolitan Community Church, and one of my students from a liturgical class was deacon, and she was a former nun. And I won't go into all the details, but they were essentially threatened with assassination. And because he was going to, he had stood by the whole same-sex marriage bill in the provincial assembly. It was voted down, but the mayor of Toronto recognized him as citizen of the year for Toronto. And they were asked to be the grand marshals for the gay pride parade. It had been 25 years since Stonewall. And they're going to have a worship service at Maple Leaf Gardens. And they were threatened with assassination. And this is the funny part. I mean, if you can look at funny in something that dark, the idiot who wrote the threat to them was the old style thing of letters that had been cut out and pasted in a letter, and there were fingerprints all over the letter, which the RCMP looked at and said, "Well, idiot, he left his fingerprints all over this, and we know by those fingerprints who this is." And yeah, he's a member of the Canadian Heritage Front or something like that. So, long story short, which is too late already, I was preaching at our Holy Cross Parish, which was like 200 feet away from the Metropolitan Community Church. And it was the gospel about laying down your life for your sheep, about Jesus. Then I talked about people over the ages, and then about these two people who were doing that very thing, risking their lives for people who have been left out. And I said, "I'm tired of this. The bishop is not talking up about it. No way can I support this. So I will be in the parade with about half a dozen other people as a bodyguard in my Roman collar with a pink triangle on. Because if they're going to shoot them, they're going to have to shoot me first." And that was when I realized that this is no longer my home. I can no longer support this institution. And so I left. And I took 3 years. The community was really good about it. Said, "You didn't get into us overnight as a member and all that, so don't leave right away." And it took 3 years to think about it, pray about it. Saw a therapist, and she said, "Oh, you're fine." The institution, yeah, I know, it's the institution that's got issues. And I have my own, of course, as a human being. But over the years, it was always, and it continues this way within Catholicism, it's the nuns who work so hard and seem to live forever. Good Lord, they live to be so old, but they live an amazing life. But they have been the real leaders in the community. And again, the issues with all the abuse problems, you don't see Sister so-and-so was arrested for child abuse. Well, maybe in some rare case, but I've not heard of it. It's always the male clergy, which is heartbreaking. That said, I still have friends in Holy Cross at the University of Portland who are very good, loving, compassionate, holy people. Friends back at Notre Dame as well. I rode back there to see one of my old mentors who was 102 at the time, and had been my academic advisor when I was 19 at the University of Portland, and was like a Zen master then, asking me some of those questions that were like smack, just like, "Wake up, kid! You're a little black and white here. You gotta think about this stuff." But again, after all this, just want to say, yes, gender has been an issue in my life. Being a gay man, not so much gender, but orientation, obviously. But I am grateful at this point in my life to have gone through all of that, because I think this, as one book calls it, the obstacle is the way. We got to face the obstacles in our lives, embrace them, and learn what we can, looking deeply into our own lives, and also have the compassion and the realization that we're not about changing others, but about changing ourselves so that others might see in us a real possibility going forward. So that's a lot. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, everyone. I'm going to offer the closing verse here. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha discussion to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, you know how it goes.